Hi, good evening, everybody. I hope you can hear me wherever you are today, listening to this lecture. I'm the senior independent director and member of the chapter at Lincoln Cathedral, a lay canon at Lincoln Cathedral, and I really want to welcome you to this sixth in the Lincoln Cathedral lecture series. What we're really asking is how can common good theology really help us all? Play our part in a spiritual and civic renewal. And we really appreciate at Lincoln Cathedral the partnership with Together for the Common Good. It's part of our wider Lincoln Cathedral Common Good project, and we're really helping us to develop and think and build on our own civic and social engagement. And today's lecture was a topic at our own chapter meeting. We talked a lot about what it is that we need to do differently and more of to make a real difference in our engagement strategy as part of our sort of real transform and thrive. And it's actually in our sort of strategic document about how we drive this forward. So timing is absolutely perfect, and we're delighted that you've joined us today. So Jenny, over to you.
Thanks, Mark. So we're really delighted to be partnering with you to put this series on for Lincoln Cathedral. But these talks are for everyone, and they're to help us reflect on how God calls us out of our current malaise in this society to a pathway towards spiritual and civic renewal. So whether it's about the economy or work, nature, freedom, politics or social peace, we're in a time of profound change. And so we're featuring speakers from different traditions, all of whom draw on Catholic social teaching to explore how Christian theology can be a blessing on public life. And so the recordings for the first five are available online at togetherforthecommongood.co.uk, and the next three run between now and November. So I have to announce at this point that unfortunately, John Cruddas is delayed in Parliament. He's caught up in a three-line whip around the immigration bill, 15 votes, which he can't get out of. So we're incredibly grateful and delighted that Lord Glassman, Maurice Glassman, has generously agreed to step in and speak for us this evening. And Mark will introduce him in a couple of minutes, and we will reschedule John's lecture for the autumn. But before we get started, I would just like to thank CCLA, who are hosting this evening and sponsoring this series. They're our longtime partner, been an amazing supportive friend of Together for the Common Good over many years, and helped support my work on this series of lectures. And CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations. So we'll be taking questions later. So if you're watching on Zoom, please use the Q&A function, or if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, do enter questions in the chat. So, Mark, over to you.
Yeah, so I'm really delighted and actually honoured to introduce Lord Glassman. Maurice Glassman is a life peer in the House of Lords and the founder of Blue Labour. He's also the director of the Common Good Foundation and professor of politics at St Mary's University, Twickenham. Maurice is one of the leading figures seeding a growing cross-party consensus around economic and civil renewal. And Maurice's expertise encompasses over a decade in Parliament, as well as a history in grassroots community organising. And he's instrumental in the original campaign for the living wage. I think Maurice may touch upon it, but I know that he is starting to work in Grimsby and look at what activity we can really drive forward there. So, but Maurice is personally rooted in the Jewish tradition. His politics, remarkably, are shaped by Catholic social thought. He's recently published Blue Labour, The Politics of the Common Good, which sets out his vision for a renewed political economy. And it's that combination of factors that make him uniquely well placed to help us all think about what is happening to work in the context of statecraft in a way that is aligned with the Judeo-Christian worldview. So, Maurice, the opportunity and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I barely recognised myself there. I really appreciate it. I also went up to Lincoln. So, first of all, I'll just begin with some thanks. First of all, to Jenny for all that you do at Together for the Common Good. I'm the director of the Common Good Foundation, so it would be really poor show if we couldn't find a way of working together, I think. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate it. And John Cruddas is my really, I would say, my closest friend in politics. So he rang me up today and he said, I've got a problem, you know. And I said, haven't we all? And and he said, yeah, but I've got a three-line whip. And I said, so have I. And then he said, yeah, but you're in the Lords and it don't matter. So I didn't really have a comeback for that. John says he's going to get here as soon as he can. He also has written a paper, so that will be, I hope, later. I'll try to keep to the topic, but more broadly, I want to talk about Catholic social thought and how it's an absolutely essential part of building a new politics. I'll talk more about that, but I also look around the table and realise, wow, I've been doing this for quite a while now, and it's really, I'm now looking out at really old friends, and it's very good to see you all. I'll begin with, three reflections before I get into the heart of the matter. The first is always for me, and Paul mentioned it, is that discovering Catholic social thought really transformed my world. It transformed my faith, and it transformed my politics, and particularly Rerum Novarum, Laborum Exercens, and Centesimus Annus as three encyclicals. I mean, really, all the Blue Labour is trying to articulate those at this moment, the idea that we are fallen beings, susceptible both to virtue and to sin, I think is an absolutely essential starting point, that the institutions that surround us are decisive in whether we go one way or the other. It is vital. It's a Dominican thing, going on. The idea that we're social beings, the Aristotelian inheritance, the idea that we find the meaning of life in our relationships and in our work are absolutely fundamental. The articulation of the common good within that is central. And I'm thinking here, we have here the old alliance of the Salvation Army and the Catholic Church that was the very, very origins of the labor movement with the Dockers strike. And if you read the articles around that time, the horror with which it was greeted, this idea that the Dockers should be paid, was minimal. But what caused enormous outrage in the editorial pages and the letters pages of the Times was the idea that the Salvation Army is a Protestant organization and Cardinal Manning fronting it up. It was William Booth and Cardinal Manning. The idea that Catholic and Protestant could work together was genuinely greeted with horror. That's the radical nature of Catholic social thought, because it was Cardinal Manning together with Archbishop von Kettler in Germany, who actually were the driving forces for Rerum Novarum and the birth of Catholic social thought. So it's a source of enormous importance to me that the origins of Catholic social thought were driven in our politics, in our society, and are ours. And obviously they've been madly neglected, but there really is no alternative than to return to excavate those origins. And that's particularly true, although I won't labour the point, so to speak, about my party. The second thing that's put is to speaking here from the City of London. The City of London is the oldest continuous democratic city, self-governing city in the world, founded by the Romans. It has a very odd place because it preceded Parliament. You know, in the Norman conquest, the conqueror basically laid waste to the rest of the country, but he got to London and he stopped. And that was because the City of London, had 5,000 men in a militia standing at the gates waiting. It wasn't. And he came friendly to London and didn't conquer it and allowed English to be used, allowed common law in the courts. It's the very origin of the pushback against the conquest, the whole concept of the ancient constitution is rooted in the City of London. And you can see through its institutions, you know, the Guildhall, where you won't be able to find a single worker. It's a banking association now, but that used to be a source of moral economy. And essentially, with a really hugely important self-governing city that then was entirely conquered by capital, became the absolute central address for the domination of capital within the framework of the maritime empire and the British Empire. So it's important to remember that outside the City of London, you know, they call it City Hall, but it is, it's the Greater London Authority. You know, it's a, you know, City of London has what, 150,000 inhabitants, and it's got over 100 elected representatives. The GLA, by contrast, has more than 8 million people and 16 representatives. I just say that if central to this is the idea, I think that we have lived through a period of time and its roots are very deep, where money has exercised dominion and democracy has been subordinated to that, and certainly what Jenny refers to as the kingdom. And the third thing is, you know, to Pope Francis said that we're not living through an era of change, but a change of era. And I think we've got to take that to heart, that our politics may seem flat, mundane, and technocratic, but the profundity of the change is very real. And we must get into position to understand that change, not to be overwhelmed by fear in relation to that, and to be able to develop a politics that is commensurate to the scale of the changes. And I, you know, what I advocate very much is our thing is that we move from contract to covenant in the way that we think that that's the essence of the biblical political economy, and it's the very essence, I think, of Catholic social thought, that we recognize that we are bound to each other in association through thick and thin, and we have a much more durable institutional system, because capitalism is fundamentally based on this idea of contract, of the idea of an exchange between hands, of equivalence. And what we've found is that leads to huge inequalities of power, huge inequalities of wealth, and we need to resurrect more durable forms of association. And I think that, you know, London becoming a city would maybe be a good place to start in, you know, beginning to think about how our inheritance is distributed, because the City of London has inherited all the ancient liberties, all the assets of 2,000 years. And London as a local authority just has to make do with what it has. So, you know, there's my thank yous. And I just want to talk about when Pope Francis talks about living through not living through an era of change, but a change of era. What are the forms? What are the new forms that we have to recognize? And the first is that the era that we have lived through for the past, let's say since 1979, let's give it a date and say that it commenced then, it's still not over, but it's definitely on the rocks. So we could just call it an era of globalization. Let's say that the technology knew no borders. Technology knows no limits, that national borders were increasingly irrelevant, that it was good that there would be a free movement of capital, of labor, of goods, of services, that this was all in the public interest. And that era has come to an end. So, you know, I'm not talking, I know that mental health is very much on people's minds, but when I talk about a bipolar world, I don't mean it in the mental health sense. I mean it in the sense that fundamental to globalization was the idea that capital would transfer its assets to China fundamentally and other areas in Southeast Asia. But China, so one of the great ironies of history is that the most successful enduring communist regime was the most hostile to labor. There were no free and democratic trade unions, that's disallowed. No freedom of religious association, that's also disallowed. But China could guarantee 24 hours production without any disruption from strikes. That's what China could offer with an educated workforce that did not participate in any way in the governance of the economy. So China offered the dream of frictionless returns to capital. And capital duly relocated to China, and we saw, you know, so when I'm talking about the change of era, we can't ignore what happened with the Brexit vote, for example. And for me, the Brexit vote was fundamentally driven by the dispossession and abandonment of our working class, that they had no real role in this future. They were called lots of things. They were called the left behind. That was the nice term. But essentially, they were seen as an archaic remnant of a previous civilization. So when we talk about the change of era, the first point about the change of era is that it is now the case that the state, the nation state, will play a far bigger role in the economy than was previously thought. Does anybody remember COVID? Does anybody remember this period? It was, for me, a very interesting, it was the first time in my living memory. Do you remember, it only lasted for about 6 or 7 weeks, but suddenly what was invisible to us, which was work, human labor, suddenly became visible. Suddenly, there were those of us who could earn a living behind a computer screen on Zoom, and there were those of us who had to leave the house and do things for others essentially with their hands. Those were truck drivers, those were shelf stackers, those were nurses in hospitals who were dealing with the sick, like those were street cleaners. Suddenly, do you remember, we started applauding people for going to work. I thought that was a very, very significant moment that of course passed. But what it also revealed was the incredible dependency on what they call extended supply chains, and that we couldn't even make face masks, you know, let alone respirators, let alone medicine. Suddenly, the incredible dependence on China for a very brief period became quite scary. So one of the effects of that has been, and it's longstanding, that the state will play a bigger role in the economy, and the working class, far from being the left behind, the abandoned and the dispossessed, are the decisive force now in elections. So the next election, just to tell you, will be this contestation for what they call the Red Wall, the people who voted for the Conservatives in 2019 and Labour desperately need to vote for them at the next election. And that will be the essential battleground of politics. And these places, and this is the important thing, is that for globalization, place didn't matter. Place didn't matter at all. You could participate in the economy from wherever you lived due to the internet and technological changes. But in politics now, place is very important. And this is our friend, as I'm now going to talk about this, which is the growth areas in the economy are very much related to what you might call relational work. So huge increase in people employed in social care for the old, huge increases in people who work in schools, working as teaching assistants, working with people with mental health problems. In all those areas, I even hear that in the city, I don't know, Andrew, at lunchtime, you have personal trainers come and take people for where they used to just get drunk and eat long lunches. They take people for intense runs and keep their fitness up. A huge explosion, but it's completely disorganized and it's contracted out and it's low paid. I mean, did you see the case? It was just yesterday that a teaching assistant got stabbed in a school playground. And I was looking into it, and it turns out that the teaching assistants aren't in the union. They don't have representation and all these things. So there's a, you know, when we talk about the people that we really depend on, their wages have been pushed down. Their training is extremely scanty. And I think in Catholic social thought, we do have the idea. Jenny spoke about a calling. I also think that the concept of vocation is worthy of retrieval. And because we are social beings, to go back to the Aristotelian inheritance, Catholic social thought gives incredible importance to association, to people associating with each other. We've seen the complete atrophy of association. But it is necessary for this to be resurrected, I think, in order for that dignity to be restored and for people to be able to participate in their working lives with dignity and with some power. So we've seen this, we've seen the emergence of a bipolar world. We've also seen the really strong emergence of a bipolar labor market, where there's extremely high rewards for professionals, for finance, for tech. And then when it comes to the substantial economy or the real economy, the care we give to others, there's very low wage, very poor representation in that. And we've also seen, which I think is also needs to be rethought, the abandonment of full employment as a goal of politics, because I think ultimately in our inheritance from the scriptures, work is a fundamental way in which we realize our creativity, our partnership with other people, and the transformation of our inheritance, the transformation of the world. I used to get into a lot of trouble, Paul, you will remember this from early Blue Labour days. I used to get into really terrible trouble in the Labour Party for publicly associating with the church, with faith, because of course it's patriarchal, sexual abuse, it's just horrible, essentially. And I used to say, yeah, but at least people of faith don't think the free market created the world, you know, that there's some prior and substantial inheritance. And I think that that's worth remembering. So why is it that I'm so wedded to Catholic social thought in terms of statecraft and in terms of the political economy? And it's fundamentally because Catholic social thought is the most practical secular guide to the problems that we have and how to begin to think of a political and institutional solution to them. So the first thing to understand about globalization is it was fundamentally based on the fungibility and dehumanization of labor, that any worker could be exchanged for any other worker. If you didn't have workers here, you could bring them in from abroad. I saw yesterday that the Dutch government fell because of issues relating to immigration, but this whole low-paid workers, disintegration of solidarity is a fundamentally important political topic. But the fundamental insight of Catholic social thought is that there is such thing as class, that there is a relationship between capital and labor, that it says that labor is the living element. I can't stress enough how labor in exercens is the most profound work on human labor, on human work, that I think has been written in the last 100 years. And it talks about the realization of the person through their labor, the fulfillment of that, the relationships that are essential, the notion of a vocation which is passed on, an inheritance in relation to the dignity of the person, and how capital is an enormous threat, because what is capital? Capital is an accumulation of inherited wealth that has become committed to the highest return at the greatest speed. In other words, it's by definition exploitative. So what is necessary is to have countervailing powers to that that can retrieve and restore the dignity of the person, and particularly of the worker. So the dignity of labor is vital. That's done in Catholic social thought as we have inherited it through a concept of vocation, of vocational colleges. It is one aspect of that, that it's done through trade unions, of building association and trade unions as necessary associations in order to limit the dehumanization of the individual worker. And in that, it teaches us something about sociability. You know, whenever I meet people and I ask them why they're doing what they're doing, and they say, because I want to make a difference, my heart weeps and it bleeds, because you can't do it on your own. You've got to do it through fellowship, you've got to do it through association, you've got to do it through building institutions and democratic institutions with other people. So that's the first and primary reason why Catholic thought is that Catholic social thought still believes in the value and importance of labor, of the human being. So labor is just another word for the human being. And the relentless exploitation of the human being and their turning into a commodity. So this is where I see the contemporary political stage, is that in the period of globalization, everything was a commodity. Right? So I'll just give you some examples that we're living through now. Water. We just allowed our water to be privatized and subject to foreign ownership, prices. It's been commodified. Now, what is commodification? Commodification is the process through which, it's gone seven, so I'm allowed to use a really horrible long word like that, but commodification is the process through which something that was not produced for sale is turned into a sale that is open, a commodity that's open for sale on the open market. So, you know, the human being obviously is a miraculous expression of love, but in the labor market, it's treated as a commodity. Water is a necessity of human life, absolutely central in the Bible. The heavens, the earth, the prayers for rain, Philip, that we regularly, you know, this is a matter of now it's a commodity. Heat, energy, all these things were considered best organized within the private sector, best organized through markets, best organized through prices. And now we're reaping the whirlwind of all of this. But Catholic social thought does not say nationalize. Catholic social thought does not say centralized state ownership. Catholic social thought has a much more sophisticated approach to this, and I would like to go through that now. So it's not only that in Catholic social thought that the human being has dignity, and that the laborer is to be respected as a partner with capital in the organization of the political economy, and not subordinate. When it's a partnership, that's a reciprocal relationship between capital and labor. But the second principle of Catholic social thought, which I think is equally significant, is, you know, bad word again, but it's past the witching hour, is subsidiarity. It's decent. The power should be exercised at the lowest level commensurate with function. In other words, the place still matters, that association matters. And within Catholic social thought, I think it gives an opening space for thinking about how we can have locally organized civic trusts responsible for water, energy. We used to have, remember the water boards on there? But things changed after 1945, the central state So I would say 45 to 79 was the period of the centralized state, when the failures of that grew to beyond the control of the politicians. That's when we entered the period of globalization, which would date from 79 till now. So now in our politics, we have to find a different way. And I think Catholic social thought opens that way. And the importance of decentralization, of subsidiarity, of local participation in the governance of the economy as well as politics are absolutely vital. So you have status, the status of the worker, then you have subsidiarity and decentralization, which I think are vital. And then you have solidarity, which is the responsibilities that we have, the obligations that we have to each other as bound by association. And all the different forms of voluntary and involuntary associations are vital. But it ultimately means that there also has to be a redistribution from rich to poor in fundamental ways, which doesn't mean that the poor don't have responsibility. They do for their good work, for their effective work, for participation. But solidarity is the third concept that binds people together in covenantal association. And then there's the stewardship of nature. You know, the idea that, as I say, that the free market did not create the world, that we have an obligation to treasure creation itself. Because if you think of it like this, then capitalism is something quite nuts. Capitalism wishes to see the commodification of creation, the creation itself. And you can see that in the aggressive resistance to any form of faith in the economy or in politics, that any, because they wish to absolutely own creation and to dominate creation. And so the resistance to that, I think, comes from human association. And as I say, Labora Mexicens and Centesimus Annus are absolutely superb. Looking at my lot from Leviticus 25 to 35, you know, in the Bible it says that when you lend, you must keep the person company. The Kesef Tolva is the Hebrew, is that you, but this is not a transactional relationship between the lender and the lendee, but this is a way that you create relationships. But the existing system we have and the banking system that we have leads far more to the disintegration of relationships and no obligation when it comes to the reciprocity between the rich and the poor, or the bank and the customer. So this is the reason why the human person has to be put. This is the paradox I always say, that citizenship will be redeemed by faith. The rationality alone cannot uphold this. Jenny, I'm asking. Okay. Well, I've got there's much more to say about this, but I'll move to the conclusion really of the talk is that we have to recognize the stark realities of where we find ourselves in terms of people of faith, where we are, is that our voice is increasingly marginalized in politics. And within the economy, but not as marginalized as the poor. There's a huge crisis at the moment, I think, in the party system. I sense no enthusiasm anywhere in relation to that, or any agenda that could conceivably take us in a different direction. I think it's our responsibility to develop those things. And to understand how desecrated the human being has become within the prevailing system. So in the economic system, treated completely as a fungible commodity, in the welfare system, treated as an isolated unit and a cost, the disintegration of the traditional, you know, institutions. I say here to the Salvation Army and to the Catholic Church, if you were to have a support for the Dockers now, how many people would come? The reality is tens of thousands of people walked down to protect the Dockers and to uphold the dignity of labour. How to renew that association, how to renew the relationship with the poor is essential. And we have to look at the menace, the menaces of poverty, the menaces, you know, that's where I came into this world. I know some of you remember COVID. Does anybody remember the financial crash of 2008? That was something. I think that was the beginning of that move that led to Brexit. But you know, that was the beginning of the disaffection with the prevailing consensus. But we have plenty of work to do to establish an alternative consensus. But the menaces are also about surveillance, about compliance, about bank accounts being terminated because people don't like the politics of the person who holds the, you know, a really strong system of corporate control that needs to be resisted. Now, I do have. I'm just going through now, kind of listing. I will conclude with 3 points. The first is that we can no longer think about the economy as separate from politics. So what we have witnessed in the era of globalization is two things. The first is, which is obvious, which is increasing power of the market, that the market has increasingly penetrated into all aspects of life, that the price system is the dominant system for the allocation of resources and goods, that there is a commodification of human social life. But equally, there's been an increase in the power of the state, that the state is the other institution, not only in terms of coercion and enforcement, but also in terms of welfare. So you have a very strong market, and you also have an increasingly strong state. But what has disintegrated in all of this is the third aspect, which is society. And that's so if you could say that the principle of the market is contract and the principle of the state is redistribution, move taxation to the center and then out again, then the principle of society, which is reciprocity, which is relationships, has disintegrated. So any agenda coming from Catholic social thought has to put association at the very heart, the restoration, no less, or you could even be melodramatic and call it the resurrection of society. Now, that's really hard work. That's, you asked me earlier, Paul, about Grimsby, building a community organization in Grimsby. Now, just to let you know, I'd like to say it's a very nice place, but it's a very tough place. And the reason I chose Grimsby was because it has the lowest levels of literacy, it has the highest levels of abuse, neglect within its public institutions. And I thought that, you know, the least of these have to lead, you know, that this is another really fundamental principle that I took from Catholic social thought, that we will find leadership from the unexpected places, from the most abandoned places. And we're beginning to see that. We're building a community organization there. And the whole goal of it is to restore society. So it's not to stand for any elections. It's not to run businesses. It's just to hold the political and the economic powers, the powers and the principalities to account through relational power. That's the idea of what we're doing there. And to restore that old alliance between the church and labor, between those two factors in doing that. And it, you know, that's why I mentioned Cardinal Manning, that's why I mentioned William Booth, and that's why I mentioned the Dockers, because that was also a society that where the state and the market were completely dominant, and society itself restored some some balance. So I think we can take some inspiration inspiration from that. So the importance of organizing. But to return to the theme of tonight, and I really hope John gets here soon, is that central to Catholic social thought and central to the politics has become is to restore the dignity of the worker through association, through vocation. I try to give this talk tonight without talking too much about stats, because I found that if you mention stats, people tune out, but I'll give you two. Is that if you look at the last, I got this from, it was published in American Compass, a guy called Michael Lind, who's an American economist, who's very sympathetic to the work that we're doing. And if you look at Britain and you look at the United States over the last 50 years, and I refer you to the to this report in American Compass, over the last 50 years, real wages have increased about 1%, if you look over the time. Corporate profits have increased by 185%. Right? I don't really think I need to say too much more in relation to this. But when we're talking about a common good, we're not talking about the domination of labor. We're not talking about unions running the country. We're talking about a restoration of some reciprocity in the rewards of the working life and in the way those are distributed. I could go on, but also to look at another statistic is that in 1979, when I went to university, 7% of people went to university and 50% of people had an apprenticeship. Now, because God likes to mock us, 7% have an apprenticeship and 50% go to university. The absolute atrophy of respect for skilled labor. And this is linked to all the other things that we talk about, the necessity of immigration, and all these things are all rooted in the lack of recognition of the fundamental importance of work in the reproduction of society, in the reproduction of relationships within society, and a sense of justice within that, that all contribute and that all benefit. I think I'm done. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thanks ever so much, Maurice. That was fascinating. I suppose I should declare my hand to you as the speaker as well. Is that as a former MD of a global bank, I remember 2008 really well. So that was a fascinating time. But for those of you that were making notes, I thought your definition of globalization from that era since 1979, that frictionless return on capital was just absolutely on point. So thank you for so much for that. But we are moving to the Q&A section of the proceedings. And remember, for those of you that are online, you can submit your questions in the Q&A function on Zoom or on the chat on Facebook or on YouTube. But before we open up to questions, I'm actually going to sort of use my prerogative as the co-host to sort of ask a question and make a couple of thoughts, really. I thought it was fascinating when you talked about the growth areas. I thought it was really interesting in that journey from moving from contract to covenant. And it was really reassuring, actually, because I sort of pulled out the Cathedral's Transform and Thrive, which is our strategic direction. When I look at what you described as those Catholic social thoughts of dignity and respect of labour, place matters, association matters, and stewardship of nature, I look at our priorities, which is about our staff and our volunteers, the dignity and respect of labour, place matters, about being inclusive, a sacred space, association matters, which is all about the inclusivity, and then the stewardship of nature, we've got an explicit, which is a net zero of 2030. So it's great that as a cathedral and as a community, my question really is, you talked about that relationship power of church and labour. What are the simple actions that we should be taking now as churches, cathedrals, places of worship? What are the actions that you'd be recommending that we took now to make a difference?
Okay, so remember what I said about making a difference. You can't do it on your own.
Yeah.
So the most thing, maybe I'll stand behind here. I was just getting closer to you, Paul, to...
Morris, Mark, John. So it's much better behind the mic for me. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, too many churches, Mark, John, you know, forgive me.
No.
I misheard from the outset. So, you know, for me, the centrality is to build relationships in the places that you are. So, you know, one of the nightmares of progressive politics is that it completely ignores the relational and goes immediately to the agenda, you know. So the way I put it is ignores Marvin Gaye's question, what's going on, and goes straight to Lenin's question of what is to be done. And we all know how that goes. And the most important thing that anybody can do, and that I try to practice in my life, is to talk to people that you live with and that you work with, and to build friendship with them wherever you are, and to hear what they say. Because what I find is that essentially the lives of the poor are still despised and their views are still despised. I remember, and Paul, you remember early days with Blue Labour, we started doing some organising work within Labour in working class areas. And the response of the party when they, you know, they said, well, we're worried about immigration. And the party said, no, you're not. It's cuts, it's austerity, you know, this inability to listen to what people are saying and the desire to not talk to them anymore once they begin to speak. It's really vital. The most important thing is to build enduring bonds of solidarity with the people around you without paying too much attention to the agenda, because the existence of the relationships is transformative of what you can do, but it can't be pursued. The idea is not to use people for your pre-existing agenda. The idea is to build relationships. Now, what you will find when you do that, and I can speak here from experience, is that people want the good, and people want love, and they want meaningful work, and they want some sense that they're recognized in this world. It's really, and it will come out in a form of political economy, that they want a decent place to live and a decent job and some security in that, but don't rush to it. So this is the point that Catholic Social Thought gave me. Is the human relationships are transformative, that love really is possible in the world, but the existing system of power and money try to disintegrate those bonds and try to disintegrate the possibility, because talking to people is very time consuming. You know, it's very difficult actually having a conversation with someone and finding out where they're at. What did you do today, darling? Oh, I had a couple of chats with some poor people. Well, you know, get to work. But that is the work. As you ask that question, that's the best, is not to promote an agenda, but just to reaffirm the possibility of human fellowship and love in the world is the most radical thing and the most enduring thing.
No. Thank you very much. I'll hand over to Jenny now. But thanks, Morris.
With pleasure.
So we've got a few questions.
Oh, yeah.
This first question is, with increasing secularisation, how do we move to a world where our economy is run according to Catholic social teaching? Often people are sceptical whether the ideas of Catholic social thought can actually gain real political traction in such a highly secular context. And yet there are politicians like you and others from across the country who are drawing on this body of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that unites you and that makes you convinced to give it your energy? And what small steps can we take to help nudge it along?
Okay. So I think we're, you know, I'm going to make a bold statement. I think that the big 20th century political ideas have run out of road. We're living through the end times of all this. As I say, state-based socialism, you know, has to account for its sin, you know, and that sin is palpable in Eastern Europe under the communist system, but also in systems of neglect and lack of accountability that were created in our country. I think that the self-love, greed, I mean, Mark, the 2008, just the degree of lying that was going on about investments, about accounting, these are all to be reckoned with, and the human suffering and the sin involved in treating people as commodities, in exclusively being concerned for your own wealth and not for the well-being and flourishing of others. Okay, so what I'm saying to you clearly, and this is palpable to me in Parliament, is that neither, do you remember, and now this is something that's going to be difficult to remember. Does anybody remember Liz Truss? Does anybody remember that particular? Don't forget that Boris's thing was going to be, there's going to be a new political economy. We're going to pay workers more. We're going to have levelling up. We're going to decentralise to the regions. Right. And so then you had the Liz Truss restoration, which was supposed to be Thatcherism, and the markets chucked her out. You know, the markets chucked her out essentially for lowering taxes and all of that. So that's been rejected. And now we've got what I consider is entirely bankrupt political leadership still trying to tinker with a system that's fundamentally failing people in the fulfillment of their family life, in their everyday life, in their local life. So the issue is on us. How do we articulate and how do we pursue a politics that's faithful to our faith, that is loving and open to all to participate and to share the fruits of that? So, Jenny, we don't have the problem. They've got the problem is that free market capitalism and state socialism have both been revealed as absolutely inadequate means of governing a society.
I'd like to come in with another question.
Yeah.
So when you talk about countervailing powers and new forms of association,
yeah,
in relation to the workplace, can you give us an idea in practical terms of what you mean? Are you talking about new forms of trade unions, or are you thinking about workers' guilds? Are you talking about forms of governance, accountability? What actually might that look like?
Yeah. Okay, so the very superficial answer is all of that. Okay, so first of all, in terms of the governance of economic institutions, there's various ways. One aspect would be corporate governance reform, where you have the representation of the locality and of the workforce on the board, so that these interests, I mean, I noticed with particular grief in relation to, I really love, you know, these are one of the things, I really love my football club, which Loughlin knows, Tottenham Hotspur, which is also an incredibly rapacious capitalist organisation. So it's this weird thing, you've got all these millions of fans who love the club, and yet they have no representation, and they just announced another 20% increase in the ticket prices. But this is all the imbalance of power. It's not just about workforce, it's also about fans and the things that we love. So corporate governance is one I'm working on with Philip Allman, who's here, this concept of civic trusts, which will be accountable to local people through public assemblies in places. It's almost back to Roman and Greek forms of accountability through the tribunes. But the whole, many, many examples of this in the Bible, of local assemblies holding institutions to account. I think that it's absolutely vital. I mean, we've just managed to bring Unite into relationship with the community organisation in Grimsby. It's been a story, but it's also to renew a concern that unions should have with the local, with the places that their members live, as well as the workplace. And that, I think, is a very effective way of addressing the decline of that. But above all, when it comes to the social carers, when it comes to the teaching assistants, when it comes to these new forms of relational work, vocational colleges and guilds. I mean, if you look at Catholic social thought, so key assumption in Blue Labour is the old is the new. There are places for forms. So I'll give you one anecdote that really interests me. A few years ago, I gave a talk at Labour Party conference, and I called for half the universities to be closed down and to be turned into vocational colleges, but the doctors and the lawyers and the dentists and the accountants should be put in the vocational colleges, because they weren't essentially academic disciplines. They were vocational practice was the core. And the next day I got legal letters from the BMA, the Law Society, saying that if I continued with this, they would take legal action, which I found really very interesting. So let's just say it didn't go down very well at the time. But the important thing is that, you know, that's what's got to be challenged. The idea that these are guilds, the BMA is a guild that protects the professional interests of its workers. So I think it's really important, the concept of a self-managing guild system in social care is vital. And that's to be combined with an effective union that can deal with employers in relation to conditions of work. So these are completely compatible ideas.
I'd like to move on to this idea of welfare to work, because the vision you're describing needs to take into account we currently have nearly 5 million people on out of work benefits. And just going back to a quote from Pope Francis, where he says that financial help for the poor must always be a provisional solution in the face of pressing needs. The broader objective should always be to allow the poor a dignified life through work. Now, skeptics might say that's all very well, but it's not practical in this modern economy, that we're stuck in this provisional position because the problem is intractable. But from a Christian worldview, obviously, it's an unacceptable, even an outrageous position to park people on benefits, you know, for 3 or 4 generations and families, for example, which we have in many parts of the country. Where we've had capital flight, where historic, you know, jobs and manufacturing have gone. So how does that shift happen in realistic, practical terms from welfare to work? What kinds of training, what kinds of jobs, what kind of local investment frameworks will actually work to make that happen? It's been tried and it's sort of failed, isn't it, in the past? What was wrong with the way it was done before?
Well, it was completely individualist. That was one aspect. There was no component whatsoever of vocation, of relationship. You know, that's what I mean. The restoration.
Saying because it was very centralized, because it was a government top-down initiative rather than doing it.
And it was, you know, we've got to add a caveat, is that we want to move people into meaningful work, not just any work. So that's what I meant. Vocational training, relational welfare, you know, and this is very
time-consuming. When you say relational welfare, you're talking about neutralised models, is that what you're talking about?
That's one aspect, but also, as I said, with the banking system, mm-hmm. is that you establish an individual relationship, and Philip's done really good work on this in the Netherlands with social care, where you have 12-person teams and they care for the same people, so that the people see the same people time after time. They're not just, you know, I don't know what I don't go to the doctor anymore because I don't know my doc. You know, you go in and they don't know who you are or what you are. This whole system has to be reorganized in that way. So yeah, I don't think we've tried any, and it's also the understanding of work. I mean, what is, you know, caring for children, caring for old people, this is by your sweat shall ye live, you know, this is the world, this is look, and how do we support those, how do we support people in their caring rather than exclusively move to institutionalization?
And we have another question here about AI and robotics.
Yeah.
So, and there's a horrific idea of, you know, a robot caring for the elderly. So how do you see the changes in terms of AI and robotics in the workplace and the wider social consequences in terms of the dehumanizing and removal of relationships?
I have distinctive views on this, and I'm open absolutely to challenge. Is that we were told that it was technological changes that meant we couldn't have full employment, and it was technological changes that meant that we had to invest all our capital in China. So essentially, I think that the working class have felt the fullest brunt of these technological changes, although I don't think it was preordained that it had to be that way. The next step is going to be the proletarianization of the professionals. This is going to hit. So if you can fill in a form on the internet with your complaints and they can give you a diagnosis, that's going to be difficult for doctors. I think the legal, you know, essentially the professionals are not going to be able to protect their domain in the way that they used to be able to protect their domain. But ultimately, no robot, they still haven't got a robot that can tell the difference between a dog and a cat, let alone your mum. You know, we tend to get a bit apocalyptic about it, but what we see is a steady growth of employment that involves human relationship. Now, and what I'm saying to you is this is good. This is very good for us, but it's to give those human relationships dignity and respect as a form of vocational.
One last question.
Oh, please.
So when I was thinking about this lecture, it really struck me as astonishing, given the scale of the change in the nature of work, that there's been so little pushback, you know, against these profound changes, these insecurity in work, wage stagnation, conditions. And so I hear you saying that it's the loss of association. It's essentially the loss of individualism that's atomized us from each other, that's divided people from each other, the loss of solidarity. And what I hear you saying is this has actually caused a concrete result. The result is that there's been no pushback against all these changes. It's almost as if people have been sleepwalking into a new reality.
Well, that's the nature of political consensus, and that's the nature of ideology. The ideologies are there to tell you that there is no alternative to the way that they are working. That's the fundamental power. Do you remember Tina? There is no alternative. So we closed down the mines, we deindustrialized, there was no alternative. And suddenly we woke up, as I say, halfway through COVID and saying, China, oh my God, you know, but it wasn't visible. And it was seen as inevitable that the market was the most efficient way of distributing resources. Nobody really, after 1983, disputed that. So, but it's not just individualism, Jenny, it's also collectivism. Mm-hmm. Is that either you do it yourself or you elect a new government that does it for you? Mm-hmm. No, I would say that what Catholic social thought has given me is the idea that if you are serious, you build relationships and institutions and associations with the people that you live and work with, and you have a great freedom to do things with that. So, yeah, it's not just individualism. And then you asked about, yeah, increasing secularization. I just want to respond very briefly to that is, and this is just to share with you. So even the most secular people have a sense of the holy, of the sacred. So, for example, I spent some time with environmentalists, and they are really aggressively liberally secular, but they do think that nature is sacred in some, that we're violating it in some way. And, you know, there's something going on with this trans debate and feminism where feminists are saying, no, I'm a woman. You know, that's that's something that shouldn't be violated, and that's something that's sacred. So I've gone from thinking that we're living in increasingly secular to an unconsciously kind of inchoate sense of the sacredness of things that's being done. And so it's just to apprehend where people's sacred is and to build coalitions and not to forget the beauty, the strength of, and the blessing of the inheritance that we've been given for our faith.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Mark's going to take over at this point.
Yeah. Hi, Maurice. Thanks ever so much for that. So a couple of three things maybe. Firstly, you've really helped me with a talk I've got to give on Saturday morning to the Diocesan Synod. So which is all about building relationships between the cathedral and the wider diocese. So guess what? I'm going to talk about building bonds of solidarity, the existence of relationships, and people want good. And it's the time when, there's always change in whatever organisation, at a time of change in the diocese. We will find that really, really, really useful. Just one other bit that I thought, when you talked there about that sort of desire for that sacredness and whatever, I've always thought that actually those people that publish books on mindfulness have actually just pulled the wool over our eyes. And actually mindfulness and this, go to an airport and see a book for mindfulness. That is just people who crave some form of spirituality or some purpose. And actually they've just... Yeah, they've tipexed out sort of various words and just sold it and made a few quid. So I think that piece about mindfulness and sacredness is really, really important. But it's been really useful. And from a Lincolnshire point of view and a Lincoln point of view, I really want to thank also, as well as yourself, Maurice, I'd like to thank Together for the Common Good. This is really helping Lincoln Cathedral. I sort of waved around our strategy document, but it's really helping us think about how we engage more with the wider civic and social relationships with our neighbours in the city, but also across a very diverse county and diocese. Whether it's from Skegness on the coast to Grimsby and Scunthorpe to Stamford and Grantham and places like that. There's a lot of variety, a lot of challenges, but also a lot of opportunities. And so for us, it's a really exciting opportunity to take the thinking that Jenny and the team from Together for the Common Good are helping us and to then put it into practice. So thank you, Jenny, and thank you, Lord Glassman, again. I'd also like to thank the CCLA again for supporting this series, the sixth one. There are more to come. And for those of you that aren't familiar, the CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations, and it's got a long history of managing assets for Christian organisations. So the CCLA also provides the Secretariat for the Church Investors Group, helping Christian investors really develop investment policies aligned with their faith. So I just want to say thank you again to the CCLA. We really appreciate your support. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Mark. And again, huge thanks to Maurice. Thank you so much. A brilliant talk. I had no doubt yesterday when there was some doubt over this, when Maurice said I could have him up my sleeve, that he'd be able to deliver it off the cuff, as it were. So really great. Thank you so much. And you've shown us how dignified work is central to a civilized, fulfilled life, and why work must always be at the heart of civic and spiritual renewal. In fact, the cornerstone of a politics of the common good. And you've shown us how, properly understood, Catholic social teaching is non-partisan. It transcends partisan positions. And that this framework, which is rooted in the gospel, requires us to be ambitious. Sometimes Christian responses can get a bit stuck. Responses to poverty can get a bit stuck, whether on models of charity or models of welfare. But without the dignity of work at the heart of that argument, these responses can inadvertently end up propping up an unjust economy. So we've got to be very careful about these politics of low expectations and not collude in this politics of abandonment. And I think people are so hungry for vision, but crucially a vision that doesn't offer the false hope of a utopia, but one that's realistic. And I think Maurice has shown us tonight that there are ways to move beyond this assumption that there's no alternative, beyond this pervasive sense of hopelessness. Towards a pathway that's something that is non-revolutionary, stable, a form of statecraft that's practical, that puts families and communities first. In fact, it's good for business as well. It's good for everyone. So thank you again. Thank you, everyone, for watching. We're going to reschedule the talk by John Crudders. You'll be pleased to hear, so you'll get two for the price of one. We'll get that rescheduled for September. And looking forward, in fact, the next one that is scheduled in the series is on Tuesday, the 17th of October, with Professor Alison Milbank, who I've asked to talk about people and planet, the common good approach to the conflicting interests between environmental concerns and people's livelihoods. Anyway, you can find out more about all of that on the togetherforthecommongood.co.uk website and at the Lincoln Cathedral website. And I hope you'll join us for all of those. So all remains to say is thank you again for everybody's contribution tonight, and good night and God bless.